You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
Sometimes he dreams he is there, in the heat of the crusher room mid-afternoon when the shift was new. On a swing shift afternoon in the uranium mill, sunlight bore hard through the smeared windows in the room where the crushers split yellow ore for the yellow cake they made. At a certain angle in the heat of the day, golden dust filled the air above the conveyor belts, and entering the room was like entering an oven. You didn't want to go in. You didn't want to begin. Once there, though, the heat took you. You got the rhythm of the place. The clickety-click of the bearings in the conveyor belts, the steady pounding of the crushers grinding rock to bits, dust the texture of chalk, mouth and nose coated. Entering the mill when the heat-sneered walls and ceiling began to sweat was exhilarating, like moving hard into a hot, fast wind.
Bay Area author Ann Cummins' second book and first novel is called Yellow Cake, named for the ore dust that settled everywhere during the heavy years of uranium production. Particularly, it settled in the lives of two mining families. Even three decades down the road, long after the mines have closed, leaving a pair of fathers gravely ill, and these divergent clans interconnected. This character-driven novel touches on the legal battles, but focuses on the people. Their loves, new and old, their pain, their habits, and their traditions. Ann Cummins' short story collection, Red Ant House, was an undisputed success as a San Francisco Chronicle bestseller and book of the year. Now in Yellow Cake, she is back with more poignant humor and honest tellings of how people live their lives. Cummins divides her time between Oakland, California, and Flagstaff, New Mexico, where she teaches creative writing at Northern Arizona University. Ann Cummins, welcome.
Thank you.
I should say welcome back.
Thank you.
I had the pleasure of interviewing you couple of years back for Red Ant House.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Wow. So we get in Yellow Cake so many things so fast. We get it all set up for us. We've got a white family. We've got a Navajo family. We've got language conflicts, as in the Navajos that speak Navajo and the Navajos who do not.
The whites who do not. That's right. Yes. The Navajos who do not,
even
right.
Within. New loves, we've got legal issues, we've got illness.
Yes.
A lot of research for the book, or were these things you were familiar with?
A lot of research for the book, but these are things that I basically grew up with. I really drew on my home territory for the material in this novel. I was born in Durango, Colorado, and grew up in northern New Mexico, actually on the Navajo Indian Reservation there. And my father was in the uranium business. So I had that in my background.
Let's just go through some of who is in the book. We start out, we meet Ryland.
Yes.
Who managed a plant.
Right. Correct. He was the foreman.
The foreman.
He was the on-site foreman, yes.
And then tied into his family, we have the Navajo family, Woody, his daughter Becky, whom Ryland can remember being born.
Right. Right.
And that clan.
Yes.
Interesting characters. Ryland, very interesting, very ill, as yes. The book starts out. And I think you do such an interesting job of showing us that illness from within. I was trying to think of other examples in literature in which we really see the sick individual from the sick individual's perspective. And I don't think there are many. We often see the caregiver in that relationship, but we're really inside with mm-hmm. Ryland.
Yes, yes. Yes, the book kicks in when he has had a debilitating lung disease for a few years and sort of has been living with something that would seem like emphysema, and he knows the symptoms very well. So, yes, he's constantly conscious of his body, but Ryland is very split because he what's going on with his body is in conflict with what's going on with his mind and his whole feeling of his life and the integrity of choices that he made in his professional life.
Well, I know as Foreman, he is the target of some blame from other characters in the book, and he questions, certainly struggles in within himself as to what kind of responsibility he should carry for workers who've gotten ill, such as Woody.
Right.
Is this book interested in who's to blame?
This book is interested in the in people who have, in moral people who have developed their own particular sense of what's right, and they do question themselves. Ryland questions himself. Woody questions himself as well. Ryland and Woody are somewhat similar. They both start out with working class perspectives. And they kind of come from a right-to-work kind of background. Both of them do. That's where they started. But, of course, Ryland worked his way up in the company and ended up in a decision-making position. And he worked his way up in a company in an industry that turned out to have lots and lots of problems and whose workers suffered health problems afterward, after years and years at the mill. So Ryland, I don't see Ryland as someone who began his life knowing the consequences of his actions. He discovered as he lived it out, basically, how complex this situation was. And Woody also, the timeline for the novel, the present action takes place in 1991, after most of the business had already shut down in this area. But the past occurred in the 60s and 70s, when these people were living it out and not understanding, you know, what the repercussions would be for them years later. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, in talking about sort of blame or judgment, I think one of the real strengths of your writing and this book is just how generous you are in portraying the people in the book and how non-judgmental the narrator is in the book. And we can maybe jump a ways away from Ryland and talk about Delmar in that sense, who, when we first meet him, you know, he is, in some senses, the literal connection between the white world and the Navajo world. He is half Navajo and half white. Illegitimate son, shall we say,
yes,
of Sam, bosom buddy to Ryland and co-worker,
right.
And Alice, Navajo woman. And, you know, we first meet him, he's kind of a punk.
Yes. he's a bad boy. Yeah.
and yet, you know, as the novel progresses, we get to see kind of how some of that came about and maybe some of his sincerity in his next road. We really get inside. Is there effort there? Not to judge, or is that sort of what you bring as the author? You just bring all of the characters to the table and they talk.
Well, I just love working with character-based fiction because it does liberate me from being judge, you know. Yes, basically that is what happens. For this novel, I really auditioned many characters, and only five made the cut in the end. So the novel's told from five different points of view. And the ones who made the cut were the ones who most engaged my imagination and whose lives I felt that I could get out of the way personally for them. Yes.
Well, it's definitely written in cliffhanger style. I mean, it's wonderful. You know, the way that it is. I mean, we've had examples certainly of sort of different scenes from different perspectives in a variety of literature. But I think in the way that you present it here, with so many voices, trading that those five voices, like you say, trading, and just, you know, it's cliffhanger is the only thing that occurs to me. It's
oh, great.
Very compelling.
I'm very glad that you felt that, because the most difficult thing for me as a writer was to learn how to write plots. You know, I always kicked in with characters. My short stories character based, and I really feel like I can get under the skin of characters. But to actually make something happen and to figure it out in a book length, and where all of the plots converge and the characters are all interrelated. Was a huge challenge for me, and also it was possibly the most rewarding part of writing the book. I just had a great time leading up to cliffhangers and then seeing what would happen next.
And you often didn't know yourself as you're writing?
Absolutely. I never knew myself, and that's my that's a liability in my process. I can't figure it out in advance. I really come at these worlds from the inside. So, you know, I'm bungling along with the characters pretty much, trying to figure out how this fits into the whole story, you know, and write draft after draft after draft, you know, sort of trying to figure it out.
Oh, some wouldn't call that a liability, though. Just that, you know, that's why your readers can be surprised, you know, because you were. Let's introduce Becky a little bit more. And she is rather quiet in her rage,
mm-hmm.
I'll say.
Mm-hmm.
That description came to me only after I finished the book, I think, you know, where I could really see her, step back further and see her. But there's some stuff going on for her.
Yes.
I love, in one more kind of humorous moment, she meets up with her Aunt Alice, mother to Delmar that we were just speaking of, who herself is kind of a renegade.
Yes.
And Becky is rather straight-laced, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
Becky's trying to place the look on her aunt's face and decides that it has come from a night of good sex.
Yes.
And Becky's quote is irritating.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about her?
Well, Becky is a 25-year-old woman. She's full-blood Navajo, but she is someone who comes from an unusual background. She didn't grow up on the reservation. She grew up 20 miles off the reservation, and she grew up in an English-speaking family, both parents Navajo. Becky's mother was adopted, and she didn't know who her parents were, and she is a staunch Christian, and Becky's father follows the traditional Navajo religion. So Becky actually is a character that when I say I auditioned my characters, I really wanted to write from the Navajo point of view, full-blood Navajo point of view, but I really didn't feel that I could gain any authority in trying to write from the perspective of somebody who really grew up with traditional beliefs. And so Becky's background of being really two religions, she's as conflicted as Delmar is in her own way. But she really embodies what I observed when I lived on the reservation in younger generations who admired the older generation and listened to them and really wants to do right by herself and her family. And she wants to do right by her, but she also is anglicized in that she wants to be a professional person. She wants to have money. She's got very Western tastes. So that's all of the different things that drive her. She, unlike Delmar just sort of is on the edge of things, and he can, he's free to choose between being a bad boy and a good boy. He was raised that way. His mother, as you say, was sort of a wild card. Becky's choices are a little not not as dynamic as Delmar's. And yes, she is angry. Her father, she loves her father. Becky's a long-distance runner, and she learned how to run from her father, who was also a long-distance runner. And what she sees is this this very healthy, strong man who gets sick and quickly declines. And, you know, so it's a smoldering rage that Becky develops.
Well, yeah, I and after her father is gone, after Woody is gone, she wonders toward thinking in terms again of Ryland, wonders to herself what the Navajo word is for murderer.
Right.
That was a poignant moment. There's a wedding going on.
Yes.
lest you think it's legal battles and other bedside scenes, which is a wonderful and deep subplot. Ryland's daughter Maggie is getting married, and it's also a wonderful setting to really see who everyone is. I mean, what other kind of contentious, stressful event could we conjure but the wedding?
Yes.
So that, you know, the stakes are up there. And we really get to see people in high relief. Sam, I see as a really interesting link among the characters. Tell us about
Well, Sam and Ryland were best friends, and they met as boys. They actually met in a mining camp up in Colorado, where in the 30s, where their fathers were both mining silver. But Sam's father died when he was just a boy in a mining accident. And Sam has grown up as a pretty self-directed man. He's also just a bad alcoholic. But he's very, very, he's one of my favorite characters. He's very much he's also a bad boy, but a very dynamic, he's somebody, to me, he embodies the American ideal of self-direction and individuality. And it's no surprise that Delmar is his son. Because, you know, Delmar also, in his own way, embodies that. Delmar, or Sam and Alice, produced a child that has his eyes open and basically feels he doesn't have anybody to fall back on. Delmar is the kind of guy who thinks that family he loves his family, but he thinks he's got to make it on his own. And Sam does as well.
Sam is just strikes me as the type of person, character/person, whom you really want to dislike, but you can't.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah.
There's so many reasons, if we made the list, not to like this man. And yet he's very, very likable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because we think, and this is something I have to remind myself of, I think, as a reader of literature, that every time I have to remind myself that it's really about human interaction. Because I think I start out thinking, okay, it's going to be about the ugliness of the occupational and environmental ignorance and negligence going on here, but it's about the people.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I don't see it as I don't want it to be I don't want to write a polemic novel. You know, I'm not interested in talking about the environment, although really serious environmental concerns come into play in all of these people's lives. But I do think it's very, very, it continues to be a conflict for lots of people, you know.
Well, with that, let's read another passage from the book. We're going to read from the very beginning that will set some of that up, some of the framework that brings all these people together again for some of them. Ann Cummins from Yellow Cake.
They come at 10 o'clock in the morning. Ryland's wife, Rosie, is at the fabric store with their daughter, Maggie, who's getting married next month. Ryland goes ahead and opens the door against his better judgment. He always opens the door when somebody rings, though he usually regrets it. He is not afraid of muggers. Muggers, he figures, will leave sooner rather than later. He's afraid of the neighbor lady, Mrs. Barone, who always leaves later, and the Mormon missionaries who like to fight with his wife. They always leave later. And pretty boy across the street, old Hal Rivers, who waters his lawn in bikini swim trunks, parades young girls in and out, day in, day out. Ladies' man, though he has a gut and a little bald pape. Still the girls like him, which only goes to show that it's not the books but the pocketbook. Old Hal stopping by every now and again to chew the fat terrifies him, though Ryland makes sure the man never knows but that he's welcome. These people today, though, Ryland doesn't recognize. He lets them in because of the young Navajo woman with them, Becky Atsidy. She has to tell him who she is. "You know my dad," she says. "You're not Becky Atsidy." "Yes, I am." He stands for a minute and admires the young woman little Becky Atsidy has become. He tells her that when he first met her, she wasn't any bigger than a thumbnail. Now they sit across from him, three of them on the couch, and Becky begins telling him how Woody is sick. Ryland shakes his head. He likes Woody. "Your dad was a good worker. Every time somebody didn't show up for a shift at the mill, I'd call him and say, 'Woody, got a cup of joe with your name on it.' And your dad'd always say, 'Okay, then.'" Ryland looks over Becky's head, out the front window, to the ash tree in the yard. "He has lung cancer," the woman says. Classy. Dressed like a TV news anchor in one of those boxy suits. Hair any color but natural, one of those poofed up, clipped and curled deals that hugs her head. "Your dad's a strong man," Ryland says to Becky. "Don't you worry." Becky's sitting between the man and the woman. The man is looking all around, beaming at the pictures on the wall. He's got his hair pulled back in a little ponytail. Skinny guy in jeans. Becky says, "They just think that maybe the mill workers should get some of the same benefits the miners got." "We're just at the beginning of this process, Mr. Mahoney," the woman says. "The mill workers like yourself and Mr. Atsidy are entitled. Tell him about the air ventilation in the mills, Bill. Bill's a public interest lawyer." "I don't have cancer," Ryland says. The woman stops. She blinks at him. He watches her eyes slide to the portable oxygen tank at his feet. "Of course not," she says. "We were wondering if you kept medical histories on your workers, and if by chance you still have... You people like something? I could put on some coffee. Rosie'll be home any minute. She's going to be mad if she sees Becky Atsidy here and I didn't give her anything." Becky says, "They think if you've got any records on Dad, it might give us a place to start." "Mr. Mahoney," the woman says, "as I'm sure you know, we made great strides when the Compensation Act passed, but it does us no good if there's no way for victims to collect. The mill workers like yourself and Mr. Atsidy are entitled. Bill, tell him about the..." "He doesn't have to tell me anything," Ryland says. The woman blinks again. She smiles. The lawyer gets up and walks over to the pictures on the wall. "Is this your family, Mr. Mahoney? Handsome family." Ryland stares at the man staring at his family. The woman says, "This is simply about workers who were continually exposed to toxic..." "Your daddy doesn't know you're here, does he?" He peers at Becky, who leans back into the couch. "They've had a party when she was born. He brought cigars and cider to the mill. Sam Behan, his own old chum, had teased him. 'During working hours, Rye?' Sam had said, and Ryland said, 'Who's the boss?' They all raised a glass and toasted this girl's birth." Ryland leans forward. The girl stares at something over his shoulder. He can't read her. Navajos never could read them. But her dad, Woody's a good man, didn't truck unions. When they wanted to bring the union in, Woody said he had a family to support. This Ryland knows for a fact. "Don't you worry about your dad," he says. "He's a strong man." He looks at the news anchor lady. Her eyes are bright as a child's, and her grinning teeth are blue-white. Her hands, laced in a fist on her lap, are white, too, and the skin pulls so tightly it looks like her knuckles are about to bust through. "One of the best men I know," Ryland says to her, "Woodrow Atsidy, this girl's dad."
Thank you.
Yes.
You know, the Navajos are so tied to the land, of course, something that you might think would give a people a stability and, you know, a rootedness that was lasting, and yet it's, in fact, what makes them so vulnerable because of the land they were on.
Yes.
I wonder if you could speak to that from personal experience a little bit, from your childhood and what you knew and saw.
Do you mean on the reservation? You know, I think it's hard for me to speak to that experience, because what I have come to understand so much of it in retrospect. I do know that just the history of uranium mining on the reservation, you know, when the mines went in there, many of the Navajo miners didn't speak English, and there was no way to have a direct conversation about health problems. And you're completely right. The sense that nothing bad can come from the land, is something that I think was just a given on the reservation. But I must say, it was a given among the white miners as well. Even though, you know, the white miners from Colorado had the history of things like black lung and other health problems related to mining, but there's health problems, yes, but as much a legacy and a lifestyle that that I know my father and even my brother, one of my brothers, feels is a lifestyle that generations have a right to, actually. Hmm. Yeah,
that's really. That's an interesting insight. Well, we've left a character out, and so I want to invite Lily to the table.
Okay.
If she'll come.
Yes.
Lily is Sam's wife or ex-wife, and Rosie's sister, Rosie being Ryland's wife. So Ryland and Sam married sisters,
yes.
The sisters of Rosie and Lily. And Lily has her own voice in this novel. She's one of those on the list of new loves. She has a new love in her life. She also has a lot of things going on from the past. And that really gets big. I think further in the novel, you realize just how much she's carrying. But do you want to say anything in introduction of Lily?
Sure. Lily is, Lily really fell hard for Sam. And she, when she found out that Sam was having a longtime affair with Alice, the Delmar's mother, and that he had a child by Alice, Lily was livid, but also grief-stricken. And we meet her 17 years after that, when she really has never gotten over being livid and grief-stricken. You know, it's one of those really hard relationships that just sort of socks you in the gut, and she's still trying to catch her breath. And yet, she's a survivor. I mean, Lily has learned how to make money, and she's got a new guy in her life, as you say. And but things get complicated for Lily because Sam shows up for Maggie's wedding, and he comes back also looking for Alice. And of course, when he shows up, all of the history and strangeness comes knocking at her door, basically. Yes.
So do your characters ever continue talking to you after a book is finished? Are you in the grocery store and Lily is commenting on the price of oranges?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, this novel was so much fun to write in the end. I mean, for the first couple of years, it was not fun. It was just a lot of chaos, and I didn't know where I was going. But they all got to be so real to me in the last year that I really hated to see it end. And I really had that delicious feeling that I remember as a child. As a child, I had imaginary friends who really were more real to me than anybody around me. And, you know, you learn how to overcome that as an adult. But really, in the last 6 months of writing this novel, I felt that my imaginary friends were right there with me as they were when I was, 5 years old.
We have to say goodbye, but tell me, are second novels as scary as they seem? is there going to be one?
I find that I am really drawn to the long form now. I'm also drawn to, I got a nice grant from the Sloan Foundation and Magic Theater to turn Yellowcake into a play. So I'm also drawn to the stage. So I'm hoping to try my hand at that.
Oh, how exciting.
Yes.
Well, Ann Cummins, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Ann Cummins' book is called Yellow Cake. For KUSP, this is Catherine Petrocelli.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.